into the wilderness. Let's take our Bibles. We're going to go to Exodus chapter 2. Exodus chapter 2 this morning. We worked through the first part of this passage on Mother's Day as we looked at the life of Jochebed. And actually, Moses' mother is never named in this passage. We're just told what happens to Moses as God works him through the process, a divine process of taking care of him. Exodus chapter 2, we're going to start in verse 10, and we'll read through the end of the chapter. When the child grew up, she brought him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. She named him Moses because she said, "I drew him out of the water." One day when Moses had grown up, he went out to his people and looked on their burdens, and he saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his people. He looked this way and that, and seeing no one, he struck down the Egyptian and hid him in the sand. When he went out the next day, behold, two Hebrews were struggling together. And he said to the man in the wrong, "Why do you strike your companion?" He answered, "Who made you a prince and a judge over us? Do you mean to kill me as you killed the Egyptian?" Then Moses was afraid and thought, "Surely the thing is known." When Pharaoh heard of it, he sought to kill Moses, but Moses fled from Pharaoh and stayed in the land of Midian, and he sat down by a well. Now the priest of Midian had seven daughters, and they came and drew water and filled the troughs to water their father's flock. The shepherds came and drove them away. Moses stood up and saved them and watered their flock. When they came home to their father Reuel, he said, "How is it that you've come home so soon today?" They said, "An Egyptian delivered us out of the hand of the shepherds and even drew water for us and watered the flock." He said to his daughters, "Then where is he? Why have you left the man? Call him that he may eat bread." And Moses was content to dwell with the man. And he gave Moses his daughter Zipporah. She gave birth to a son, and he called his name Gershom, for he said, "I have been a sojourner in a foreign land." During those many days, the king of Egypt died. And the people of Israel groaned because of their slavery, cried out for help. Their cry for rescue from slavery came up to God, and God heard their groaning. God remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. God saw the people of Israel, and God knew. And today's text is a story of the wilderness. I don't know about you, but I don't especially care for those wilderness experiences because they're notoriously dangerous, they're difficult, they're barren, they're dry. But the wilderness motif seems to be a favorite motif in Scripture, at least among the stories of God's people. You think through several of the different stories. There's Abraham, when they're looking out at which land to choose, and Abraham gives Lot the first choice. And of course, Lot chooses for himself the lush green valley of Sodom and Gomorrah. And Abraham's left with the wilderness and God. And God reminds him of that. You think of Jacob as he's running away. He's forced to run away because of his own bad choices. He's running for his life, and he's confronted in the wilderness by a vision of God as his angels ascend and descend a ladder from earth to heaven. We see that before they enter the promised land, the nation of Israel spends significant time in the wilderness, more than they had to, but on purpose God brings them into the wilderness for a time to instruct them and prepare them for the promised land. Before David goes to the throne, he spends significant years wandering and running for his life as he escapes from Saul, but God prepped him in the wilderness. Elijah, right after he has the victory over the 400 prophets of Baal, finds himself recouping in the wilderness. The Apostle Paul, before ever he's received into fellowship with the church in Jerusalem, or before he's ever sent out as a missionary from Antioch, he spends 3 years in the desert, in the wilderness of Arabia, as God hones his man and shapes him and fits him for his service. In fact, it's interesting to note how the Gospels begin their different stories of the life of Christ. We're familiar with the book of John. In the beginning was the Word. The Word was with God. The Word was God. Takes us back before time. You come to Matthew. This is the genealogy, this is the book of the genealogy of Jesus, the Christ. It goes back to Abraham, son of David, son of Abraham. You go back to the book of Luke, and you have these angelic visitations where God interjects and speaks after 400 years of silence. And he speaks to Zechariah. He speaks then to Mary. And he speaks to the shepherds and says, here he is. The little gospel of Mark, as it presents Jesus, the servant, presents him immediately in the wilderness. This wilderness motif is something that God uses primarily with his servants, and it's used frequently. In fact, God frequently forges his people for use in his service by taking them out into the wilderness. This is where God gets his servants ready for service. We'll see that Moses has the same experience in the passage that we're looking at today. I think this text provides for us three aspects of God's wilderness walks, if you will. It's been pointed out several times in several different places that Moses spent his time of ministry over the course of 40 years, from the time he was 80 years old to the time he was 120. 40 years of ministry is when Moses had the opportunity to shine and became the greatest example in the Old Testament of what it means to serve God in a public role. Those 80 years beforehand, 2 years of preparation for each 1 year of service that God provided his servant. And so God preps him largely in the context of this wilderness. When God brings his servant into the wilderness, it's important for us to keep some things in mind. First is that these wilderness walks occur because of our belonging to God, not for lack of our belonging to God. Sometimes when you're hanging out in the wilderness and there's nothing to drink, sometimes when you're hanging out in the wilderness and you're hearing the coyotes off in the distance and you're wondering about your security, you're thinking, hey, maybe I'm hanging out here because I'm stuck and God forgot about me and I really don't belong to Him in the first place. Maybe God just left me here to dry up and rot. As we look at the life of Moses, as we look at several different experiences of wilderness walks in the Bible, we see that these come particularly because we belong to God, not because we don't. And as we look at the life of Moses, this is especially true. We see in the first part of this chapter, the first 10 verses, that Moses belongs to God by intervention. And though God is not mentioned in the first part of the story, we're introduced to his sister, we're introduced to his mother. Just previous to this, we're introduced to some midwives. We're introduced to Pharaoh's daughter. We're introduced to women. The only one that we have that's a guy is Moses, and he's the only one who's named in all of these characters. But the whole point is that God was shaping, God was intervening, God was directing, and using weak vessels such as women to overcome the directives of mighty Pharaoh, who himself remains unnamed because he doesn't get any credit. And his plans come to nothing when he confronts God and asks, this God that you call by the name of Yahweh, I don't know him. Why should I listen to him? And then for the next 10 chapters, God's going to show him why he needs to listen to him. As Moses comes on the scene in this second chapter of the book of Exodus, we see that Moses already belongs to God by intervention. Up in the book of Acts, up in the book of Hebrews, it talks about he was beautiful to God. Here in the first part of this chapter, verse 2, the woman conceived and bore a son, and when she saw that he was a fine child, she hid him for 3 months. If we were to skip up, we won't, just for lack of time, but up in Acts chapter 7, where Stephen tells the story, he says, she recognized that he was beautiful to God. This one stood out in the plan of God. This one stood out because he was formed by God. He was forged by God. He was given by God. God was intervening already on his behalf. we see that Moses belongs to God by intervention. He also belongs to God either by instruction or at least by intuition. Back in the book of Acts, chapter 7, verse 25, when it tells about this story, it says that Moses was instructed in all the wisdom of the Egyptians, and he was mighty in his words and his deeds. And when he was 40 years old, it came into his heart to visit his brothers, the children of Israel. Seeing one of them wronged, he defended the oppressed man and avenged him by striking down the Egyptian. And he supposed that his brothers would understand that God was giving them salvation by his hand. But they did not understand. Somehow, and we don't know how, either because God told him, this is what I have in store for you, or he just kind of expected that this was what God had in store for him. He believed that he was a part of God's plan for bringing the enslaved children of Israel into freedom, the captives free. He knew that this was a part of his calling. And so he belongs to God either by instruction or by intuition in fulfilling this calling. Moses belongs to God then by choice. We see that in Hebrews 11:25, it says, when he came of age, he chose, choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a season. Moses was God's man by choice. As we look at how things shape out here, we see that he denies his Egyptian heritage. He embraces the Hebrew heritage of his brothers. Look there in verse 11. One day, when Moses had grown up, that means he's responsible now for the choices that he's making. In fact, Stephen says he's 40 at the time. Josephus tells a little bit about Moses, that the Pharaoh at the time when Moses was growing up had no sons. So Moses would have been considered a grandson of Pharaoh, being the son, adopted son of Pharaoh's daughter. He would be being groomed at this point, either him or one of his brothers within the court to take that position of leadership. He would be learning everything that he could from the arts to the sciences. He wouldn't be engaged in menial labor. That was looked down upon. He would be engaged in military exercises and learning warfare and strategies. Josephus has it that Moses, around in his 30s, actually led a military campaign and won some military victories on behalf of Egypt. Stephen has it in his story that Moses, at this time, was mighty in words and mighty in deeds. He was standing, making a name for himself, standing out among his brethren at the time. And now it's with this context, this battle-hardened general, this young man who's ascending to the throne in the eyes of all of Egypt, truly a prince of Egypt. It's this one who comes on the scene at this time, and it says he grew up and he went out to his people. And he looked on their burdens. The idea here is that he went out before Israel could get out of Egypt. Moses had to get out of Egypt. Going out to the Hebrews was a life-changing trip. It meant that Moses left the palace in order that he could go and see the people. And the idea is, when he leaves the palace, he takes his heart with him and he embraces the Hebrew people. He goes out to them. He literally had everything to lose and absolutely nothing to gain. The Hebrew people are the lowest of the low. In the artifacts that we have of ancient Egypt, it talks about how those who gather wood, those who work in the fields, those who feed the animals, those who make brick, those who haul water, those are the people who are to be pitied and despised. Nobody in their right mind would stoop so low as to choose that. Except Moses. Moses left all of the feather beds, all of the cedar paneling, all of the Wi-Fi. I'm just kidding, they didn't have Wi-Fi back then, except in the pyramids. He left it all behind so that he could stoop to identify with the lowest of the low. Denying that Egyptian heritage, he embraces the Hebrew heritage of his brothers. James Ackerman says, in this story, Moses did not become the hero, the legitimate agent of God, until he burned all the bridges between himself and the wealth and power of the Egyptian court. Aren't we afraid to do that? We grow up with all the privileges, we grow up with all the rights that we enjoy as Americans, and we have it all at our feet. Who in their right mind would put all of that aside and go to serve in, and you can fill in the blank, go to serve in China, go to serve in Zambia, I hear they even have snakes there, go to serve in wherever. Who in their right mind would do that? Nobody except somebody who's called. Nobody except one who's being groomed for God's service, as Moses was. Ian DeGede says he gave up a position, pleasure, and prosperity, and by so doing, he rejected three of the world's biggest temptations. Narcissism, a focus on self. Hedonism, a focus on pleasure. And materialism, the things we can have and hold and touch. The things that you and I are enamored with. Ourselves, comfort, pleasures, and the things we can possess. These wilderness experiences occur because we belong to God, not because we don't. Moses belongs to God, and because Moses belongs to God, God calls him out into the wilderness. You see, before Moses' wilderness experience, Moses didn't know what it was like to be enslaved, to be in want, to be in need, to be in peril. As we look back at the end of this chapter, we're going to see that Moses is a shepherd. We look back on what an Old Testament shepherd looks like, and we see back in chapter 31 of the book of Genesis, where Jacob is recounting to his wives how that he had been suffering. In fact, he's talking to Laban, and he says, I've spent my life out here in this wilderness. I've been beaten on by the sun. I've been rained on through the rain. The wind has howled over me. There's been nothing but the moon over me at night. I've been in danger of wolves and predators. Being a shepherd wasn't this sweet pastoral scene that we see painted in sweet pastels and sold in Christian bookstores. These guys were rugged. They were beat up. It was harsh. And when Moses goes into the wilderness and becomes a shepherd, he gets just a small taste of what his brothers had been experiencing for a long, long time. In fact, not much, but it gives him some empathy. It takes him out of that plush court position and puts him in a place of destitution. I think we need to keep in mind that these wilderness walks, when God calls us to them, they occur because of a desire to obey Him, not a lack of a desire to obey God. You go through this text and we see that Moses, as God's man, is confronted with injustice. And he wants to do something about it. Let's read the end of verse 11. He went out to his people, he looked on their burdens, and he saw an Egyptian. The idea, the wording there in the Hebrew is, he saw an Egyptian man beating a Hebrew man, a man of his people. One of the commentators, I think it's Alter, says that the repetition of this echoing of man, an Egyptian man, a Hebrew man, and then that there's no man to intervene, invites one to ponder the role and the obligation of one man as one man victimizes another man. He goes out and he sees a man beating up on another man, and as a man, he intervenes. He wonders, what can I do about this? Hasn't God put me in this position of leadership? Hasn't God put me in this position of power? Hasn't God put me in this position of, and you can fill in whatever blanks, God had providentially intervened in the life of Moses to put him where he was. And Moses, at this moment, is going to use all that he has to free the people of God. And when he strikes that Egyptian, the word here, at the end of verse 11, he saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew. He looked this way and that and seeing no one. It's the same word. He beat down the Egyptian. The idea is that the Egyptian was beating down the Hebrew slave. And it's the same word that means to bring him to death. He's driving him down. He's bringing him into submission, bringing him to his knees, driving him to the grave is the idea. And so Moses, in like fashion, beats down the Egyptian and accomplishes his objective, beats him down to the grave. There's just a problem with that. That was Moses' grand idea. It wasn't God's grand idea. As Moses goes out, he sees, it says, he looked on their burdens. And the idea is he watched them at their hard labors. The word to watch there has the idea of more than just watching. It means seeing and being drawn into. Seeing and having your heart changed by what you see. Seeing and having compassion towards the one who's being beaten down. And as Moses goes out, he sees and it changes him at his core. He knows that this is wrong because in verse 12 he looks this way and that way. And seeing no one, he proceeds with his plan. One writer, I think it was Swindoll, says, you know what? Interesting. As Moses comes to this decision in his life, he looks horizontally this way. He looks horizontally that way. The one direction he didn't look was up. He looks to see if any man's watching. He's looking to see if he has the right time. He has the right time, so he does his deed. But what does he have to do with the body once it's dead? He buries it in the sand. But it's found out. Now, I don't think that he did a poor job burying him in the sand. I don't think he left the toes sticking out, or the nose sticking just out of his grave there in the sand. It wasn't that he dug it too low. What happened is Moses was acting in the flesh. And just like with Cain of old, the very first murderer, God says, his blood cries out to me from the grave. It's found out. It's discovered. He's going to be like Adam and Eve at that first chapter after the creation stories in chapter 1 and chapter 2, chapter 3. They do their deed in the flesh. They have this brilliant idea of doing their own thing, their own way. And all of a sudden, they realize they need to hide. They're discovered. They're naked. They're seen by God. And so they cover themselves. Reverend Child says Moses must act in secrecy because he, in fact, has no authority at this time. He took something that didn't belong to him at this point. He took the initiative when it wasn't his to take. Walter Kaiser states, minds capable of great virtue are subject to great vice when that God-given asset is turned into a liability through haste, pride, or stubbornness. And Moses seems to exercise all three. It's not that God didn't want his people free. Moses just decides to do it ahead of God's timing. It's not that God didn't want his people free. It's just that Moses thought he was the one who was going to do it for God rather than God doing it for his glory, for his people. He seems to be stubborn in pursuing a course of action that he knew himself to be wrong. The next little story, we see in verse 13, he went out the next day. Behold, two Hebrews are struggling together. And he says to the one in the wrong, why is it that you strike your companion, your brother? Listen, I've just exercised my prerogative as hero on your behalf. And he comes out the next day to claim his throne, to lead the charge, to lead the rebellion against Pharaoh and his army. And he goes out to his troops and they say, who died and left you in charge? Get out of here. What, are you going to kill me too? And all of a sudden, he's left with his mouth hanging wide open. The people that he expected to follow behind him, the ones that would bring him into his position of authority and leadership, they're rejecting him. But we see it interesting how it's worded here in verse 13. He went out, and behold, two Hebrews are struggling. And he says to the one who's in the wrong. Moses is very conscious of right and wrong, of justice and injustice. We're going to see this again in just a minute. When it comes down, he's in Midian. In verse 16, the girls fill up the troughs with water to water their father's flocks. Verse 17, but the shepherds come and drive them away. So Moses stands up and he saves the ladies. He's the knight in shining armor. Moses has a desire to exercise God's justice. This is a good thing, okay? But he has a desire to do God's will Moses' way. I'm sure we never have that problem, do we? I'm going to do this for God. We start out with the best of motives, the best of intentions, and we wind up with toes sticking out of the sand and saying, where did I go wrong? What was the problem here? The problem was I was trying to do God's will my own way. God works in the lives of His servants to help us understand that He doesn't need our help. He wants our obedience. He wants our hearts. He doesn't, in fact, need me to be God's hero. He wants to be my hero so that He can use me. All I have to do is open up my mouth and tell people about Him. All I have to do is obey. All I have to do is wait for His timing. Sounds pretty easy, doesn't it? And if you ever tried it, you know how difficult that is. Though he embraces this Hebrew heritage, he's questioned now by his brother as to his authority. He embraces the Hebrew heritage, but he's still identified later on as an Egyptian. And down he moves down into Midian, and the girls call him an Egyptian. He's a man without a home at this point. He's a man without a country. And he takes up solidarity with a man of the desert, one Reuel by name. The name of Zipporah's father simply means friend of God, or shepherd of God. The girl that Moses ends up marrying is Zipporah. Lady Bird is the idea there. Come down to the end of the chapter, and Moses is here in a land. He doesn't belong. He doesn't fit. He wants to obey God. He has a desire to obey God, but because of choices in his life to identify with the people of God, he finds himself estranged from the people of God. And though he has two sons in the desert, only the first is named. It's named Gershom. Ger for the idea of stranger, foreigner. Sham means there. I'm a foreigner. And it either means in this place in Midian, or I'm a foreigner there in that place in Egypt. Wherever it is, I don't fit. I don't belong. You ever feel like that? You're in the wilderness. God's brought you there on purpose. Not because you don't belong to Him, but because you do belong to Him. Not because you don't want to obey Him, but because you do want to obey Him. And He wants you to. But you find you just don't fit. I think a final thing we need to keep in mind when God brings us on these wilderness walks is that these occur to begin a life that can be used, not to end a life that can be used. Put yourself in the place of Moses. All of the best in Egyptology, the hieroglyphics that Moses would have studied, we're told that that's the hardest writing to interpret. It takes a lifetime for some to be able to master the hieroglyphics of Egypt. Chuck Swindoll was saying that when he just wanted to get an idea of what this looks like. So there were these three pelican-looking things, And then there was a decapitated something with the head laying on the ground. He said, aha, I know what this means. It means, Chuck, run for your life. You're never going to get it. He interprets these hieroglyphics. He learns all the mathematics of the age. In the book of Acts, it says that he was trained in all the wisdom of the Egyptians. Apparently, there was a phrase at the time, because Egypt was the world power. If you had wisdom that was comprehensive, you were said to have the wisdom of the Egyptians. The wisdom of the gods, the wisdom of those who are in touch with the gods would have been the Egyptians. There would have been astrology. They would line up their pyramids mathematically by the stars. Moses was no slouch. Moses was one of the finest scholars in the world of his day. All he had to do was snap his fingers. Somebody would come. They'd bring him whatever delicacy he desired. They'd bring in the stuff that Jacob sent down to Pharaoh up in the land of Canaan. He could have anything from any corner of the world anytime he wanted it. Chariots, he had his choice. Horses, he had the fastest. Moses would have owned him. Moses had everything. We see that Moses, in this one act, throws it all away. Everything that he thought that could be used by God. And now he's got to run. Now he's got to hide. Why? Because he decided to do it his own way. He decided to do it in his own time. Can you imagine as he's sitting down at that well out in Midian? He's sitting there probably, his chin on his knee, just thinking, what have I done? What have I done? I've thrown it all away. There's no way God can use me now. You ever made that mistake? That mistake that you thought God can never use you again. You had so much going for you. You had the Christian Character Award in your Christian school. You were voted the most likely to succeed in your senior class. You graduated at the head of your class. You had it all. And through whatever decisions, either of your making or somebody else's, it's all in rubble at your feet. And you think, everything I could have done for God, up in smoke. Done. Gone. God brings you to a wilderness experience. But the whole point of the wilderness experience isn't that your life of usability is at an end. It's just that it's at a beginning. And God is deconstructing your life with you at the center of it so that He can reconstruct your life with Him at the center of it. That's what happens for Moses. We see that as he makes this move, up in verse 13, he goes out. There's two Hebrews wrestling with each other. He talks to them. Now it's not Egyptian against Hebrew, it's Hebrew against Hebrew, and he's trying to create this brotherhood. He's trying to reconcile them, bring them together, lead the charge. They want nothing to do with him. They accuse him. They throw him off. He's lost the moral authority to lead them at this point. And we see that he runs out into the wilderness. And it's there in the wilderness as the shepherds drive away the shepherdesses that, it's interesting how it says, verse 17, the shepherds came and drove them away, but Moses stood up and saved them. He saved them. He uses a powerful word here. He didn't just come and help them out a little bit. He drives off these shepherds. He comes to their rescue. They would not have had the water for their sheep had Moses not intervened at this moment. Then it comes down to the end of that verse. He stood up and saved them, and Moses watered their flock. This is interesting, because the next verse, their father Reuel says, how is it that you've come home so soon today? Well, an Egyptian delivered us out of the hand of the shepherds. And he even drew water for us, and he watered our flock. You know what God was doing for his servant at this moment? God was making him a servant. I told you before how it was a part of the Egyptian hierarchy, monarchy, educational system to look down and even to suppress those who are in the lower echelons, the lower strata of the society. Never, ever stooping to engage or participate in the manual labors of the day. Moses just threw away the palace, finds himself sitting by a well, and God starts working on his heart and says, Moses, you're concerned about justice, but I don't need a hero. You're concerned about justice, but what I need is a servant. I need somebody who's willing to use the strength, the power in those arms trained for warfare to lift out water and dump it in a trough for a bunch of women with a bunch of sheep. Wow. You ever feel like you're doing something below your pay grade? You ever feel like you've been called to do something that anybody could do, and somehow you got stuck doing it? God is in the middle of reconstructing your life by humiliating you, of bringing you to the place where it's no longer about you, but your eyes are open to that place of being used in service for others, watering their flock. It doesn't even belong to him at this point. And eventually, it's still the flock of his father-in-law. He's watching his father-in-law's sheep. These are never said to belong to Moses. But he becomes okay with that. He becomes one who waters the flock of somebody else. Ah, God says, very good, my servant. Because I happen to have a flock that I need somebody to water. And Moses, when it's all said and done, you come to the book of Numbers, chapter 12, and it says, Moses was the most meek man in all the world. We think of that word meek, and we think weak. It's exactly the opposite. That word means power under control. Moses could have licked anybody in an arm wrestling match. We just had Colleen's aunt and uncle here with us. He's 45, something like that. They've just sent their second child off to college. He's been in the Army Reserves for the past year. He works out every single day. They just met up with him on furlough. He said, we got our arms on the table and we did the one arm wrestling match and he beat me. I just had to do it gratuitously just to get it over with, get the humiliation done. Moses could have beat anybody in an arm wrestling match. Moses was the strongest of the strong. Moses was the manliest of all men. But Moses took all of his strength and God harnessed it, so that no longer would he use it for his own purposes. Oh, he did one other time. And God said, Moses, that cost you the promised land. That flamboyant temper. What do I have to draw water from a rock for you? Moses, ho, ho, ho. That one cost you. Again, because you glorified yourself rather than glorifying me. I thought we talked about this some 40 years ago in this wilderness. Okay. God is harnessing his servant so that he can use him. There's a pride and self-sufficiency that God is working out. I like how Swindoll says this. There's only one thing worse than being at the end of a self-directed life. That's being in the middle of one. At least at the end, you're done with it. You've written the bad chapters and you're moving on. Moses is in the middle of this and God is harnessing. God is polishing. God is chipping away, refining a jewel that will be fit for his use. As we look at this story in the book of Exodus, we find that it's about redemption. It becomes the paradigmatic expression of what God's redemption looks like in the Old Testament. It's referenced over and over again in the Psalms. It's looked to in the book of 1 Corinthians chapter 10, how God brings his people out. Moses then is compared with Jesus in the book of Hebrews. This is never really a story just about Moses. This is a story that always anticipates Jesus Christ. And as we see Jesus going out into the wilderness, learning obedience, the book of Hebrews says in chapter 5, verse 8. For Moses, this was a detour. This was a 40-year detour before God could use him. Jesus Christ needed no detours. Jesus Christ did everything right the very first time. Moses just points to him, but the book of Hebrews chapter 3, Jesus was more faithful than faithful Moses. Jesus didn't need any detours into the desert. And it's at this point then that God steps into the picture. God's got him at a well, watering somebody else's flock. He still feels like a foreigner in a foreign land at the end of verse 22, verse 23. Now during these many days, we find out later it's 40 years. The king of Egypt died. The people of Israel groan because of their slavery. They cry out for help. And their cry for rescue from slavery comes up to God. Now four active verbs are directly tied to God at this point. And this is the first time we see God in the story other than the midwives fearing God and giving them households. And God heard, and God remembered, and God saw, and God knew. As Moses is spending his time 40 years on the backside of a desert, he's in the wilderness, he's spinning his wheels and getting absolutely nowhere. God's program was still in progress. God was putting all the pieces in place. God was raising up this one for such a time as this. God was preparing everything so that in the fullness of time, God would send forth His servant to redeem His people out of their slavery as sons of God. We're told the bigger picture in Galatians chapter 4, verse 4, when Jesus does it for us. We're given a picture of this in the Old Testament when God uses Moses to do this for the people of Israel. God's program is still at work. God is about to intervene, but it takes some time to take off the rough edges of this servant, to remind him that my ways are higher than your ways, my thoughts are higher than your thoughts, my timing is different than your timing. Moses, now I'm ready to move because now you're ready to be used. Have you blown it in life? Have you found yourself in a wilderness experience without blowing it in life? Have you found yourself out in the desert wondering, maybe God's done with me. Maybe I'm not really His. Maybe I just thought I wanted to obey Him. I seem to be doing a bad job of being able to do it. God's got to be done with me. As Swindoll wraps up the first of his three chapters on this section, he drives home two take-home points I think are worth us taking a look at. The first is this. When the self-life has run its course, we're bound to settle in a desert. In this story, Moses ends up where he ends up because he tries to do God's work his own way. In the flesh, in the strength of his own power. It gets him nowhere. It winds him up in the desert. The second truth is this. When the self-life finally settles down, the well of a new life lies near. Moses thinks he's done. But he's done sitting next to a well. A well, a picture of life. A picture of life in the middle of a desert. And God's going to use Moses' experiences over the course of that next 40 years as he leads his people out into the wilderness to experience their God, to hone and to shape not just a man, but a people that God wants to use for his glory. You know, God frequently forges his people for use in his service by taking them into the wilderness. Because sometimes God needs to put us in a different place, a different position, so that we can get him in his proper position. God can't use us, folks, until we learn to let God be God. And the truth is, he doesn't need us, but he wants to use us. But he won't use us in the way we choose to be used. He'll use us in the way that he chooses to use us, because he's God. And when God does it, God gets the glory. I think sometimes that's where I go wrong, because I tend to want that. I wonder about you. I wonder where you're at today. I wonder where you're standing. Where you're standing in your own strength. Where you're fooling yourself that you're doing God's work and not letting him do the work for you and through you.